Heart of Darkness. A Little More Sonic audio story. Written and directed by Elmar Vogt, based on the novel by Joseph Conrad. Narration and post-production by Doris Rubruck. Scene 1. Summoned by the High Council.
When the High Council of Gallifrey summons you, you do not dally, you obey. Even more so, when the message reaches you with the seal of both the Lord Chancellor and Castellan Kellner. I thus aborted my current mission the very hour the subspace call reached me. My original task, to see how a civil war was developing in the Trimeris constellation, had never been high priority, and I could just as well leave a robotic probe to record the events until I'd return, which wouldn't take long. Or at least, so I thought. I arrived at Gallifrey in my TARDIS and had a welcome committee expecting me, consisting not only of the Castellan, but also of a sizable number of guards, which led me to the Lord Chancellor himself. It was the first time I got to meet Barusa in person. He sat behind his huge desk, all respectability and authority, but there was a taint in the atmosphere, as if all the insignia of his station, which surrounded him, had lost their lustre. His right-hand aide, the Castellan Kellner, was obviously nervous. I still had no idea what all that was about. The message calling me back to Gallifrey had been as terse as one could imagine. "We have lost a Time Lord," Barusa finally revealed. What was that supposed to mean? Losing a Time Lord? Someone had died? Or had they lost track of him? "There was an experiment a short while ago," Kellner continued. "An attempt to link the Matrix to a TARDIS cloister bell, and from there to the operator of the TARDIS." "Let's get to the point," Barusa demanded. The Castellan skipped the technical part. "Let's say the experiment was not exactly a spectacular success. The pilot performing the link was found barely alive." "Of course he was immediately brought to the hospital," Barusa took over from him. "And for the first 2 days or so, he seemed to make good progress." "But that didn't last," I surmised. The Castellan shook his head.
"No, it didn't. Probably he only faked his sanity while pretending to recuperate."
Faking one's sanity, I thought. An interesting concept.
"He then vanished from the hospital," Kellner said. "And only hours later we found that he had stolen our TARDIS."
It was Barusa's turn again. "He sent us a message before he disappeared in deep space. It was only one sentence, his new name." I understood the significance of this gesture. When Time Lords turned their back on Gallifrey, they most often did so by renouncing their birth name and assuming a moniker of their own. I involuntarily held my breath.
"It seems he's calling himself the Vector now, whatever that is supposed to mean."
I exhaled. I had been worried that the refugee's new name would have been that of a friend of mine, the Doctor. But this was not the case. The Vector, an entity that consists of a magnitude and direction. That was the mathematical definition. Something heading somewhere would be the more informal explanation. But where would this hapless test pilot head for? "I presume you want me to find him?" I then asked the logical question, and both Barusa and Kellner nodded. "How?" Kellner first answered a different question. "Why?"
"We have reason to assume that he's actively interfering in the business of another race, and not with the most benevolent intent, to put it mildly. As for the How, he produced a little device from the folds of his tunic. This is a muon tracer. It will allow you to follow the muon trail of his TARDIS, he said. I summoned my courage before I went on. I don't usually question the High Council. Your Excellency, but why did you choose me? Why not simply sending a regiment of council guards after him, I queried. Berusa slowly shook his head. Non-interference. We have all reason to believe that the Vector has entered a system inhabited by sentient creatures. I understood. This pretty much ruled out any brute force approach to dislodge him from his chosen sanctuary. I accepted the muon tracer from the Castellan. And if I find the Vector, what am I supposed to do with him? The Castellan and the Chancellor exchanged a quick glance. We need to be honest with you, Berusa muttered. The Vector is dangerous. When he fled from the hospital, there were casualties. Several casualties. We don't want him to be dead, the Castellan cautioned. That should only be the last resort. But this threat needs to be neutralized. He showed an uneasy smile when he realized that these instructions were of little use to me. To this end, here's another item for you. He passed me a device, which was the size of an apple, made of ultra-black material, reflecting no light whatsoever. Literally, only a shadow I was holding in my hand. A massive hole of nothingness which seemed to float in my palm. It's a fractal bomb, the Castellan explained. If you activate it, it will throw whatever is in a 3-meter radius around it into the Schrödinger folds. I drew my breath in, understanding the consequences. Schrödinger folds? Where the fringe regions at the borders of the universe, where the dimensions became fractal in nature and got entangled in an ever finer mesh of knots and loops, losing themselves in an infinite maze. Whatever was trapped there, there was no way back for it into our universe, not in an eternity of lifetimes. If you manage to catch the Vector, subdue him, and render him harmless, then do so by all means. If not, use the fractal bomb. The Chancellor's instructions were succinct. A few minutes later, I found myself back on my way to my TARDIS, still a bit dazzled. Kellner was accompanying me. You haven't told me, I wanted to know from him. These experiments, were they sanctioned by the Council, or did the Vector perform them on his own initiative? The Castellan avoided my glance. He knew what he was doing, was all he said. When we had arrived at the TARDIS, the Castellan hesitated and then said, there is another thing I need to tell you. Berusa wasn't completely candid with you. I waited for him to complete his sentence. These deaths at the hospital, that wasn't murder committed by the Vector. These were suicides.
Scene 2. Encounter in Deep Space.
The Castellan had shaken my hand before I left Gallifrey in a gesture which expressed he wished me success, but didn't expect it. I wondered what they would do if I didn't return. Send another one-man mission? drop the non-interference and go big guns, or simply hush up the issue, hoping the Vector could be forgotten about? In my briefing, I had received more questions than answers. What had been at the heart of the experiments that drove the Vector off? What were Barusa and Kellner so obviously afraid of? Why had they chosen me, a space traffic and development controller, for this mission? Did they even know themselves, or had I merely been a suggestion of the Matrix? At least the muon tracer worked nicely. It was a slow and laborious process, but every time the Vector's TARDIS had dropped from the time vortex into N-space, I was able to pick up his track again and follow it. I travelled through a respectable amount of time and space. The Vector had, it seemed, visited the Sontaran homeworld before the Sontarans appeared as a civilized race. And he had even ventured out to Skaro, Vel, Considine, and as far as Utopia. At first I thought he wanted to shake his pursuers off his trail, but then I realized he made no efforts to hide his muon track at the turning points of his route. It dawned on me he was simply undecided where to go next. When my TARDIS reached the next stop of the Vector, I was surprised. I found myself in the middle of nowhere, in deep space between the star systems. Why had the muon tracer brought me here? Then I noticed a tiny little blip on the scanners. It was a small spaceship. Obviously, the Vector had decided to pay them a visit. Upon closer examination, I found out why the scanners hadn't registered the ship immediately. It had all its systems shut down and showed virtually no energy signature, no homing beacons, not even a distress signal. Upon approaching, I saw that the ship tumbled end over end through space. It was a wreck. I found myself biting my lips. This did not bode well. Examining it would be tricky, as the Mandala, as the ship was called, belonged to the race of the Taliturians, fairly short creatures, so it would be difficult to find a room inside large enough to accommodate my TARDIS. This wreck had lost its artificial gravity and its atmosphere, so I had to don a spacesuit.
Exploring the Mandala would become a nightmare. From the start, the corridors on the ship were claustrophobically narrow passages for me, and in my bulky suit, I was afraid I might find myself stuck and unable to turn around to get back. It got worse when I found out how the Mandala had lost her atmosphere. A sizable hole in the hull accounted for that. It seemed that nobody had used the bulkheads to shut off sections of the ship and retain habitable decks. What surprised me even more was that the hole had been torn into the hull from the inside. One of the Taliturians had employed some kind of plasma tool to cut the ship's skin open. I know, because I found his body beside the hull breach. He still clutched his plasma lance. For a moment, I was tempted to think of a particularly inept ship mechanic who had doomed the whole crew to a death through asphyxiation, but that would have been very much out of character for the Taliturians with their reputation as diligent engineers. Besides, the automatic should still have engaged the bulkheads. As I wound my way through the rabbit hole-like maze of steel and Andurian sheets that was the Mandala, I found the rest of the crew dispersed throughout the wreck. Most of them had already been dead by the time of the hull breach. Some had apparently killed themselves with shots to the head. Others must have taken toxic substances. Within the complex machinery of the ship, all had found ways to kill themselves. The guy with the plasma lance had just been one of the more ingenious. It felt like a bad dream, and I wish it had been one. What had the castellan said? The deaths at the hospital had not been due to attacks by the vector, but were suicides. Had the vector arrived after the Mandala had fallen victim to the disaster? I didn't like to think of the alternative at all. With considerable difficulties, I extricated myself from the labyrinthine Mandala and set the muon tracer to pick up the scent of the vector again.
Scene 3. The Outpost.
The closer I came to the vector, the greater my doubts became what I would do with him. Should I simply sit there and wait for him to knock me out? Had he had a hand in the killings on board the Mandala? And should I consequently not take any chances but use the fractal bomb on the first occasion to fly home and be done with it all? I decided I would keep a clear mind and not use the bomb outright. I'd listen to what he had to say and defer my judgment until then. He had a right to be given a chance. Besides, there was no reason to trust the Chancellor and the Castellan indiscriminately. They had never told me why he was supposedly so dangerous. The muon tracer caught my attention. This time, I was sure I had finally caught up with the vector. I had been led to a star system on the outermost fringes of its galaxy, and the tracer found no tracks leaving the system again. I looked at the data. The inhabitants called themselves Eloi. According to the records, a quite peaceful, almost docile race of humanoids. They had developed sub-light-speed spaceflight and established a few colonies throughout their system, but neither the stars nor time travel were within their grasp. The central star of the system was peculiar. It was a black sun, a star that emits only heat but no light. Consequently, the whole system was embedded in an eternal night, with one half of the sky occupied by the large grayish galaxy whose outcasts they were, and which illuminated them with only a diffuse leaden shine. I picked up unusual radiation from one of the outer planets of the system. My TARDIS computer suggested that this originated from the core breach of a nuclear reactor, and I felt a shiver running down my spine. Would the history of the Mandala be repeated here? Upon approaching the planet, the similarities became clear. The Eloi had had an outpost on this nameless planet, inhabited by one or maybe 200 of them. Disaster had struck them in the same way as the Mandala. Not in the shape of a battle fleet with missiles and torpedoes, but through small arms fire. The reactor pile had gone supercritical and initiated a meltdown, but that was the consequence, not the beginning of the destruction. I transferred into the station. The Eloi were of a different breed than the Talitorians. Where the Mandala's crew had committed suicide, everything here pointed to a crew that was bent on brutally killing each other. The walls enclosing the resulting carnage were full of gruesome graffiti. "The truth is the end." That was a slogan that occurred often along the walls. Which truth? Had the vector told them of any truths? And why couldn't they cope with that? Or was the vector just following the trace of destruction this ominous truth maybe had left behind? One thing was clear. The level of aggression had gone up from the Mandala to this outpost. Finally, I found a survivor, barely alive.
hidden away in one of the corners of the ruined station. When he saw me, he looked at me, intently at first, then bitterly. "There's not much left of me, hmm?" he whispered, as if he had been able to read my thoughts. "Vector, you call him," he continued then, and this time he apparently really had known what I was thinking. How else could the wounded Eloy come up with the name? But before I could say anything, he croaked, "You'll find him on Homeworld, but you will find out. The truth is your end, too." He gave a bitter smile, sad and increasingly angry in his last seconds. And before I could ask anything, he drew his last breath, opening his eyes wide and staring into the void he met, like a flame that shortly before it dies burns brighter for the last time, and after that all I could do for him was to close his eyes. So, the Eloy's home planet would be my destination, where I would meet the Vector. I thought about the fractal bomb in my TARDIS as I went back, avoiding the strewn bodies of the Eloy best as I could, and pondered the strange dark prophecy the dying Eloy had made. Which truth would prove unbearable for me?
Scene 4. Under a Black Sun.
The last few billion kilometers towards the center of the system of the Black Sun were really just a hop for the TARDIS. I orbited Homeworld for a short time, gathering information about the planet, the Eloy, and the Vector. Homeworld was scary to look at. Any planet without sunlight is scary, I knew that well enough, but Homeworld was a particularly trist, dreary, and colorless place. With not enough light to support plant life, the planet was covered in vast swathes of a grayish-purple, glistening and shapeless mass, which looked like gigantic kelp on the verge of decomposition. As opposed to what I had seen at the outpost, here, the Eloy seemed agreeable enough. But something was wrong here as well. At first, it was only a vague feeling I got from collecting newscasts and scanner images. After a few hours, I could put a finger on it. Homeworld seemed to be dying. But not from some catastrophic event, a nuclear war, a plague, or a cosmic collision. Rather, its air was that of a clockwork winding down. A sense of gloom pervaded the planet, which was hard to reconcile with older records, which showed the Eloy as jolly people, well capable of having a good time. But this was gone, swept away by a grayish wind. Cities had been abandoned, industrial plants had been left for good, sometimes without shutting them down properly. Bridges had collapsed. Some regions of land were under the cover of dark clouds, not rain clouds, but smoke, dust, and soot. In these regions, houses were destroyed, whole streets, in what appeared like a savage war. The radio and TV stations were full of supposedly good news, yet a mournful and sad countenance of the newscasters belied their messages. Large parades of empty-handed soldiers, huge throngs of listless children united in a joyless song and dance, watched by crowds of routinely disinterested bystanders. I couldn't help but sneer at the monitor screens. Homeworld bore all the hallmarks of a dictatorship gone terribly awry. And it wasn't difficult to find out who the head of this dictatorship was. The logo he had chosen for his rule was an arrow. A bit trite for the Vector, At least he didn't put too much of a personality cult around himself. Much more than portraying himself as the one who brought the dawn of a better tomorrow to the Eloi, the Vector stressed the fact that he was the sole ruler of the planet now and for the foreseeable future, and that resistance would immediately result in the truth. I was electrified when I heard the broadcast. The truth. Neither the newscasters nor anybody else found it necessary to expound which truth they were speaking about. Obviously, everyone on Homeworld was sufficiently indoctrinated to understand the meaning of the truth. Last week, in the village of Traslagar, one segment reported matter-of-factly, a conspiracy of rebels was uncovered. The village was subsequently exposed to the truth, accompanied by pictures of burning houses and fighting in the streets. I stopped the recording of the news transmission and rewound. The skirmishes in the streets of the doomed village had caught my attention. The Vector's regime did have a kind of militia. I had seen them. They wore uniforms at least as naff as those of the Chancelleroy guards of Gallifrey, with their tacky arrows. But for some obscure reason, the Vector's troops were not employed in the fightings at Traslagar or elsewhere, as far as I could tell. I wasn't watching a punitive expedition. There wasn't a uniform to be seen anywhere. This was a civil war, rebel against rebel. I turned off the transmission, not comprehending what I had seen. It was time to land on Homeworld.
Scene 5. In the court of the Vector.
The doors of my TARDIS opened, and I stood in the dimness of the galaxy spread across half the sky, blotted out in one circular spot by the black sun from which a strange, intense heat, but no light, emanated. The air was filled with a sickly smell, reminding me of bad breath. I braced myself and stepped outside. The TARDIS had landed inside the presidential courtyard, or however the Vector may have called his residence. He had made no effort to conceal the position of his headquarters, and he had not taken any measures to prevent anybody from landing. No interference shields, no temporal ripplers. He had made it a smooth ride for me. Apparently, the Vector hadn't had time or inclination to leave his mark on the architecture of the planet. For a residence, he simply had taken over an existing building. That seemed, at first glance, an almost modest move, until I realized this had not been the central of the previous dignitaries of Homeworld, but a temple, a sacral building. The Vector hadn't installed himself as just any run-of-the-mill power-crazed dictator. He had made himself their god. I swallowed. Minutes after I had stepped out, doorways began to spew out several platoons of uniformed Eloi in good order. As they took position around the courtyard, I wondered if it would have been better to show up a bit more discreetly. But the guards showed little aggression. Three of the more ornately decorated of them, officers by all appearances, stepped towards me and honored me with some obscure kind of salute. Now I understood and allowed myself to relax a little. These guards were not sent to capture or kill me. They were the welcoming committee. Was the Vector, after all, not such a bad person if he invited me in this cordial manner, when he could just the same have me gunned down in an instant? I was led through the inner portal by the guards, which were reasonably polite with me, no shoving, no manhandling. We then went through a large hall. At the best of times, homeworld was lit by only the dim twilight, the perpetual dusk from the central galaxy. Here in the halls, it was naturally even darker, and statues and paintings in the niches and alcoves were nothing but shapeless schemes, shadows of shadows, not the images, but the ideas of gods and demons, which had been superseded by the Vector. We entered the sanctuary, and here I saw him for the first time. Only a single candle lit the room, like a vestige of the times when the Vector had been more like a human being and had to rely on his eyesight rather than being the all-powerful creature he seemed to consider himself now. The candle lit up for a moment, and I got the first good look on the Vector's face. He was mad, stark, raving mad, not the drooling, insipid kind of mad, with vacant inward eyes locked inside a prison of the mind with blurred walls, but powerfully mad, a reason that had left his soul behind, madness with a stare that is all edge and splinters, the radiant kind of mad, the infectious kind that reaches out to you with feverish fingers. I grasped the fractal bomb again, more tightly this time. Welcome to the Eloy homeworld. I've been expecting you, he stated matter-of-factly after he had sent his guards away. The silence hung heavily in the old temple room, accentuated by the reverb from its walls. The shadows between the pillars watched, motionless, helpless even, maybe. Did you know I was coming? I responded. He tilted his head in a peculiar manner and waited for a second with his reply. It doesn't take a genius to understand that Gallifrey sooner or later would send someone. They had to.
And don't you want to know why I'm here? But again, he only shifted his head.
That's pretty obvious, isn't it? The Time Lords want to find out how and what I'm doing, whether I'm a danger to them or to anyone else. And if so, you have orders to, as they put it, terminate me with extreme prejudice.
A hint of a smile played around his lips.
That's the logical thing to do, wouldn't you agree?
I nodded. Only now I noticed that the Vector was naked. I saw the moving flesh of his body, skin and muscles, lit by the candle and the diffuse, sullen rays of the galaxy. It looked as if the Vector was changing in and out of existence before my eyes. But there was something else I noticed, a small, pulsating red light. It came from a little box which hung from a string around his neck and which he currently held in his palm. What kind of device was this?
Wouldn't you agree?
He repeated with insistence, since I had lost myself in contemplation. Then he seemed to get bored and continued.
The Time Lords, which one sent you?
I didn't think it could hurt, so I answered truthfully, Chancellor Barusa and Castellan Kellner. The answer, in all its banality, seemed to please the Vector. He shifted his body and seemed a little relaxed.
I would have had you killed on the spot if you had lied, he told me.
I swallowed a little harder. It would be a good idea to humor the Vector.
But you speak the truth. Who else would send you? And what did they tell you about me?
Not much, I decided to stick with the truth as I went. An experiment gone wrong. You stole a TARDIS. He replied,
Naturally. They wouldn't tell you the interesting part. I heard a sound from his direction, unsure whether it was a hoarse laugh or a cough.
What sort of experiment they had exposed me to? Don't you want to know before you go on with my eradication in the name of the High Council? The Time Lords control space and time, as you well know. Barusa's latest idea was to control the mind as well. Not exactly novel, but at least he went on about it in an unusual manner. His plan was to expose the innermost thoughts of everyone as a key to bring peace about in the world. Aren't misunderstandings the beginning of all trouble and strife, he used to say. Kellner, always the practical man, had chimed in and said how much more effective discussions would be if we understood each other at all times. Not too absurd, don't you think? I remained silent, and the victor went on. So, they set me in an apparatus and turned on the power. But it wasn't quite as workable as they had envisioned. It felt as if my brain was ripped apart and as if every single neuron and nerve was torn in a different direction. Then they managed to turn the power down. I came to myself again, but this only led to a different kind of torture.
He stopped.
Yes, I had volunteered to take part in those experiments.
He anticipated my question.
But I didn't have the slightest idea how it would turn out. All of a sudden, I stood in the middle of 1,000 voices screaming at me. I could hear everybody thinking their most profound thoughts as well as their impulses, their instincts. And there was no way of shutting those voices down, of turning away from them.
He let the words hang in the stale, turbid air.
Didn't they do something about it?
He actually sobbed.
Yes, they did something about it. But it took them forever. Long enough to make a saner man than me go crazy. They finally managed to turn the voices off in my head. But the damage was done.
Another pause of a second. And then the word that electrified me.
I had seen the truth. I had learnt it, and I have it in me.
The truth? What is it?
I immediately inquired.
Which truth are we talking about?
The truth is different for every person. My truth is different from yours or from anybody else's out there. Even Barusa's truth is different, but I pass it out as I deem appropriate.
To the poor devils on the planet you have occupied, I only thought it.
He gave me a thin smile.
Don't worry. I will let you have your truth as well. In time. And then you will understand me.
His voice balanced on a thread between a promise and a menace. It seemed I was not ready for it. The vector clapped his hands, and servants showed up and brought some food and drink. I ate a little and sipped some of the wine in silence, while the vector watched me from the shadows.
Scene 6. In the Heart of Darkness.
I still sat in the unreal twilight of the temple palace, opposite the god who had cried in my presence.
Why don't you kill me outright
I suddenly heard my voice, surprising myself. It felt as if homeworld made me lose my inhibitions. Thank goodness, I had phrased my thoughts as an open question rather than a challenge. Accordingly, the shadow of an ephemeral smile moved across the victor's lips. "The thought has crossed my mind indeed," he replied. "Of course it would be feasible, but what would it be good for?"
"Gallifrey would send another ship," I continued his train of thought.
"Exactly. And another, until they would finally send a whole fleet or use the services of the Jadoon. The Time Lords must be hell-bent to stop my dealings here, so I only have a small number of options to keep up my little play."
One didn't have to be the champion of the Gallifreyan Academy to understand the choices. Either the Vector won me over to be his companion, or he would make an example of me so gruesome and terrifying that it would deter the Time Lords from sending another expedition, writing off the Eloi as a lost case. Neither option appealed much to me. "The truth," I resumed the earlier topic. "What is it?" He smiled, this time more genuine, although it would have been too much to say there was warmth to it.
"I hope you don't expect anything like the meaning of life or such paltry morsels of wisdom," he explained and fondled the little device around his neck again.
"I've seen the people in the village which you exposed to the truth, and I've met the ship you devastated and the outpost. Everyone seems to be killing either themselves or the others once they realize the truth." He nodded very slowly.
"Indeed. Already on Gallifrey, where they hospitalized me, Time Lords are not given to ready aggression, so they opted for suicide rather than murder."
"Yes, that was what Kellner had warned me about."
"You see, the experiments had made me hear other people's thoughts."
"That was when the truth hit me." Instinctively, I held my breath in anticipation.
"As I told you, at first I was completely helpless, until the medics managed to implant a little device in my brain which allowed me control of this ability. And I hadn't forgotten my experiences, so I fixed this here together."
He held up the little box for me.
"Really, just a bit of tinkering, but it allows me to project onto others the power to read each other's thoughts as well."
Quite obviously, he expected me to pick up the clue, but I couldn't. What was so bad about reading your fellow's thoughts? The Vector bent forward a little.
"Of course, as opposed to me, they have no way of turning down the voices once it starts. They hear the others constantly. You don't think that's bad?
No, you don't think.
But the truth is, this way I force them to be honest to each other. Always, all the time. They can mince their words, but they can't hold their thoughts. And they're exposed to the thoughts of the others. That is the elixir of truth I make them taste. You still don't think that's bad? Just imagine, how often have you yourself, with all good intentions, held back your thoughts? Not responded with ire to a perceived insult, not shown impatience or indifference? How often have you feigned sympathy for the pathetic, hopeless cases? Do you honestly tell your superiors what you think? Your subordinates? Your peers? And how many of your compliments are really from the bottom of your heart? Our hearts, brimming with white lies,
shrouded by conscience. The truth. That is how we really see our fellows, how we constantly judge each other, whether they are uglier than we or prettier, more stupid or more clever, how we are jealous, haughty, scared or appalled by them, and we are wise to never be honest with them, but dissolve the bitter pills of our sentiments in a leaden goblet of sweet words. Not anymore. I am the vector that transmits the disease of truth. I gazed transfixedly at the little box around the vector's neck. He was right, of course. Unless a saint was talking to another saint, we are all constantly passing judgment about those around us. But we're wont to keep this to ourselves, or release it only nicely wrapped and in small doses. The vector, instead, tore down all veils and walls and flooded and flushed everyone with the truth. Every thought was then a pinprick or a cutting glass, every word a bucket of ice water, slaps of the hands, blows of the hammer. Every move you made triggered a turn of the screw, not one sincere smile in the world anymore. There were really only two options in this incessant torrent of bleak, naked, untempered truth, once you were in there. I had seen both on my way here. And you know what is best to it? The vector woke me from my reverie. He was grinning broadly for the first time. I have become the ruler of a planet without the use of violence, without force, even without any intrigue. Not a single gunshot. All I did was ripping the masks off their faces, and that made me their god. Curious and curiosa, I shouldn't be hunted down. I should get an award for that. He started to laugh like a maniac, a non-ending laugh, a howling of insane exhilaration, the laughter of one tickled to madness. Before I knew what I was doing, I had triggered the fractal bomb and thrown it at the vector. I raced back to my TARDIS. The vector was gone, trapped in the Schrödinger falls between dimensions on the fractal fringes of the universe, where straight lines weren't straight lines anymore, but clouds at right angles with themselves. There was no way for him to return from there. Throwing the bomb at him had not been an act of deliberation. Some instinct must have decided that if I started to ponder the use of the bomb, then the vector might intercept me, and thus I had triggered the weapon without thought. But why did my heart still beat up to my neck, with the vector gone for good, while I tried to reach the apparent safety of my vessel? Maybe the vector was right. And maybe I was afraid to accept that his reign of terror, established upon the Eloi and easy to establish upon any other society, was really nothing but their reign over themselves. A far more carnal fear rose from the 2 or 3 seconds which elapsed between throwing the bomb and effecting the disappearance of the vector. I clearly had caught him unaware. But he still had been able to direct his little black box towards me. And even after he was gone, in a flash and a puff and some ethereal smoke, paradimensional dust in the afterglow of an otherwise lightless universe, I felt the effects of his box kick in with me. I began to hear voices, a silent murmur at first, the rustling of non-existent leaves on infinitely faraway trees, but it grew louder with every beat of my heart's. He had pointed his weapon at me, and he had struck me. I was beginning to be able to hear the thoughts of the Eloi. I was the last victim infected by the vector. Still, it was faint, almost inaudible. But the whispering, the murmur, would grow stronger and stronger, and soon an incessant stream of thoughts pouring from every direction would overwhelm me and turn me into either a suicidal maniac, a mass murderer, or the monster the vector had become. My TARDIS gave me only a brief respite, I knew that. With the seconds ticking, the minutes being the bricks that would make up the wall immuring my future, I realized that only one option was open to me. I had to regenerate. Regenerate quickly. Decide upon a new body, a new mind. No matter which, as long as I could cleanse myself from the dreadful Maya's touch the vector had bestowed upon me.
Purge my soul from the truth. It was done. I was a new person. The murmur was gone, the rustling. I was deaf to it again. Yet I had paid a price for it. The vector's disease had scarred me forever, no matter how many times I would shed my skin. I had received a glimpse into the human condition, and the human condition had imprinted itself on me. No regeneration could flush that from my mind. I was a different person. A person which would turn his back on the society of Time Lords, Gallifrey, all the laughable, pompous buffoons thinking they could run affairs by watching them. I would be different. I would be someone who took affairs in his own hands with my knowledge about the nature of creatures all over the universe. And of course, I would adopt a new name, like all who shook Gallifrey's dust from their shoes. I think that name should be the Master. This was Heart of Darkness, a Little More Sonic audio story. Written and directed by Elmar Vogt, based on the novel by Joseph Conrad. Narration and post-production by Doris Rubruck. Audio engineering, Brian Hillesheim. Production assistants, Barbara Hasselmann and Sina Vogt. Special thanks to the Uferpalast Kino in Fürth. Visit us on the web, littlemoresonic.com.